Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. The story of forced cotton labor in Uzbekistan goes way back into the Soviet history, but the practice continues 27 years into Uzbekistan's independence. In the peak season, the cotton picking involves over a million citizens, including minor children. But lately, there has been some positive signals coming out of Uzbekistan. In other words, the man who led this practice for most part of the independent Uzbekistan has had a change in heart, and he wants to abandon this practice once and forever. He is no other than Shavkat Mirziyoyev, the former prime minister and current president of Uzbekistan. As a sign of progress, apart from promises, recently Tashkent invited a coalition of anti-forced labor activists in part to discuss this matter. With two members of the delegation among us today on the Majlis, we would like to ponder on just how serious are the authorities to end this practice, and what has to happen to abandon this, and what role the NGOs like Cotton Campaign will be playing going forward. So without further ado, let me introduce the panel. We have Alison Gill, an associate with the Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights. Her agency monitors the practice of forced labor in cotton fields of Uzbekistan. Also joining us, Rudy Porter, head of the Europe and Central Asia programs at All Solidarity Center. Steve Sivertlu is with us, who is the Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher, as well as my colleague, Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you.
Very nice to have you. So, Rudy, there's a saying in Central Asia that when someone comes from a long trip, people say what you have been eating and drinking is your thing. But tell us about what you heard and what you have seen there. Of course, you had a mission and a number of items on your agenda, especially on how to end the forced labor in cotton fields of Uzbekistan. So tell us, please, about your trip.
Well, the Solidarity Center that I represent has been part of the Cotton Campaign for over 10 years, and we've been working on this issue with all of our partners at the Cotton Campaign. The trip was, I think, very positive. Mm-hmm. We saw some positive signs, especially a move by the government to free a trade unionist who was in prison, who had been tortured. He was freed while we were in Tashkent.
Yeah.
That was extremely positive for us. But I think we should note that it is far too early to declare mission accomplished on the task of eradicating forced labor. I point out that the ILO, which is operating in Uzbekistan, last year found 336,000 victims of forced labor in the cotton harvest.
Yeah. Alison, anything you'd like to add, especially specific topics that you raised and the people you met and especially the responses you got from the authorities there?
I would echo Rudy's framing that it was a very positive visit overall. The conversations we had were high level, they were constructive, and I think they were very frank about the problems and about proposed reforms and just how much of a struggle it's going to be. I would point out, though, that one thing that really remains concerning, I think, to all of our organizations is that the messages that we got from government officials tended to vary from agency to agency. And I think that, you know, to resolve a really difficult problem like forced labor, it's important to be honest about what the problem is and what so you can grapple it with effectively.
That's interesting. So what you are saying is that there was no harmony in thinking of the Uzbek authorities. So can you be a little bit more specific in what did the contradictions looks like in the messaging from their side?
You know, we heard very open acknowledgement of the problem from the labor ministry. And they're obviously a crucial ministry in dealing with labor issues and labor rights and protecting labor rights. And the labor minister and other officials that we met with from the labor ministry were very open and honest. They acknowledged the depth of the problem and the struggles ahead, and they seemed to welcome our recommendations. Other ministries, however, were much less forthcoming, and in fact, many of them denied that forced labor remained a problem. You know, I'm thinking specifically of the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Water Resources, the Farmers Council, Uspakta Sanawat, which is the procurement and export agency that deals with cotton. And this is really troubling because there needs to be a common understanding among the key agencies that are tasked with overseeing the cotton harvest and with dealing with the problem of forced labor.
Let me bring in Steve, you here, like this apparently a contradictory position that our colleagues have seen in Tashkent. Is it kind of a typical there? How to read this?
Well, you know, I would echo what my colleagues from the Cotton Campaign are saying. I wasn't on the delegation this time. I was in Washington on some of those same days viewing the dynamics around the delegation from, you know, that was a accompanying President Mirziyoyev on his visit to Washington, which was obviously a big deal. And I think that the commitment to on the cotton issue, you know, in some ways, maybe it wasn't a coincidence that our delegation was in Tashkent around the same time, because we know to what extent I think the government feels that it has dealt with a lot of pressure on this issue over the years. And I think it's felt that it's really needed to report and show or demonstrate progress. But, you know, I would report some of that same tension that Allison and Rudy were just talking about. I was sitting at an event with Senate Chairman Sadiq Safayev, who, you know, echoed some of those sentiments that the government was committed to fighting the issue. But when we actually brought up the fact that the ILO had found over 300,000 people being forced to pick cotton during the 2017 harvest, he was surprised and expressed doubt at those numbers. So I think that tension is real. And what it speaks to, in my feeling, is it speaks to this. There needs to be a strong chorus of voices, starting with probably the World Bank, which is investing so much in the agricultural sector. That chorus of voices has to remind Uzbekistan constantly that it's too soon to declare victory. Yeah. That this commitment to fight cotton is a multi-year process, and no one should be declaring mission accomplished prior to us actually seeing an end to the practice. So the commitment to end the practice is very clear, but the practice is still very much alive.
Steve, these are very valuable points. My question is, like, you have this mixed message that you felt during this conference in Washington, D.C., and what our colleagues were saying. What's the origin of this mixed message? How to read this?
Well, you know, it's hard to get inside the minds of officials, but, you know, this system is run so deep, and, you know, change has happened in Uzbekistan, you know, in such a quick period of time. You know, some being on the ground a lot over the past year, some activists have reported to us that, especially on the local level, governors or hakims of regions, some of them seem to sort of openly be hedging their bets about whether or not President Mirziyoyev's various decrees and the commitment to end cotton practices and forced labor is really going to win the day. So I think, you know, some continue to believe that they have to enforce a quota system, which means pressuring farmers and under penalty of punishment and imposing all sorts of really draconian forms of pressure in order to just sort of hedge their bets. And I think it's really important that we see a number of measures of follow through from the central government to ensure that there's accountability this coming, you know, 2018. 2018 is going to be really extremely important for seeing how this plays out.
Mm-hmm. Could I jump in on that same question?
Sure.
I think we should remember that it was not that long ago that at all levels of government, the entire problem was denied. If we go back 5 years, when it was primarily children doing the cotton harvest, the government denied that children were doing the cotton harvest and denied that children were missing school for the cotton harvest. And then suddenly it became clear they had substituted education and healthcare workers for the children, and they declared that they wanted credit for removing the children that they had just denied had been there. Then they denied that there was forced labor of adults, that there was any kind of mobilization of public sector workers. Now we see the massive change in message from the president, the prime minister, deputy prime minister Narbayeva, the minister of labor, acknowledging the problem. That is a major step. We can't address this issue without first admitting that the problem exists.
Yeah.
The difference that we're seeing is that as we get further out to some of the other ministries, they are still locked into the old practice of denying the problem exists, thinking that that is the positive way to impress the higher levels of government. We want to see the acknowledgement of the problem go all the way down the line to all ministries and all levels of government. And that would be a major step.
Apart from your meetings, Rudy, with the officials that you mentioned, were you free to roam around, allowed to meet, like talk to anyone you wanted, or it was kind of a scripted trip? Tell us a little bit about logistics.
First of all, the Cotton Campaign delegation was not there to monitor forced labor. We did not make attempts to go out to the cotton fields to see if anyone was being forced to work at that time. We didn't make visits to just random visits. So that we should be clear, that was not our purpose.
Yeah.
But in the meetings that we were allowed to have, we met with civil society activists. I do not think it was scripted. They were able to say what they wanted to say to us. They were critical of many aspects of the government. Just to give you an idea, one of the activists said the 2017 harvest witness in some ways was worse in that many of the people who were forced to work had been coached very heavily to tell those monitoring forced labor that they were not being forced into the fields. So the civil society activists said there were many other aspects that had been, that they had been using trains for the first time to get people into the fields. So I felt the discussions with activists outside the government were open, and that even they reported a feeling that they had more freedom to speak openly about this issue of forced labor, which is positive.
Mm-hmm.
One other point real quickly, in a meeting to prepare for the delegation with, this was a meeting in Washington with the Cotton Campaign, Deputy Prime Minister Narbayeva stated very clearly that anybody will be welcome to monitor the harvest in 2018. And I think that's significant, that if for the first time people are not punished or harassed or pressured because they go out into the cotton fields to talk with people to see if there's forced labor, that would be a major step forward for monitoring whether forced labor is eradicated.
No, it's a major promise. Do you think it's realistic?
Well, I think like all of this, the important thing is what actually happens. The statement from the government is significant. It's a statement that has not been made before. Clearly, in the past, people were punished severely for reporting on forced labor in the cotton fields. And the important thing is now to follow through on the action and to show that if someone goes out, which we know there will be civil society activists, Allison, her organization, works closely with civil society activists. She might want to talk about this, but the important thing is the follow-through. We want to see that it actually happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bruce, we are kind of in the same shoes today. Please jump in and comment or ask any question you would like to ask. But so far what you heard, Bruce, so what's your impression? Is it really happening? I mean, are they really ending this practice as they say they will?
Well, we know that last year they did not. I mean, we've already heard that was true. And our Uzbek service reports that they had already conscripted people to get them out in the fields to get the fields ready for planting. So we know that some people have been sent out. We couldn't make a guess at exactly how many because we couldn't get information from all around the country. But certainly they've impressed people into service once again to prepare everything for the fields. You know, what I would say about this is obviously I'm watching what the officials say, the top guy, the other ministers and everything. It's easy for them to get out in front of the microphone and say this is a horrible practice and we're going to get rid of it. But, you know, at the end of the day, cotton is they need the hard currency from the cotton crop, and they always have needed that. The government will set target figures, quotas, that everyone has to meet. And it's up to officials at a lower level to meet these target figures. How are they supposed to meet that exactly? It's easy for the people in Tashkent to get reports all of a sudden and say this governor or or mayor or district chief or whatever was forcing people to go out in the fields, and we told them not to do that, you know. But at the end of the day, they get the cotton and they blame the whole practice on somebody at a lower level for doing this, you know, to try to ease up a little bit of the pressure on the local officials that I just named. You know, let's face it, this has been in the national mentality for, you know, going back to the Soviet era. The cotton campaign's a big thing. You know, I've mentioned on this program before that when I was out there all the time, you'd see in big rock spelled out on the side of hillsides, you know, that Pachta Bizning Altinum is, this cotton is our gold. And everywhere, you know, I mean, enormous. You could see it from kilometers away driving into these towns. It was portrayed as a patriotic duty to go out there. Now, nobody likes to do that stuff, I'm sure. I've been out there in the summertime. I've picked cotton in the summertime when I was out there. It's not a good job. And the last point that I would just bring up is, you know, again, they do need the cotton. And I've heard comments from people in the Uzbek government saying that we're going to mechanize, you know, we're going to put more money into mechanization so that this stuff can be done by, or get the farming equipment that's going to be able to do it. And when you look at what they're spending money on right now, none of it is going to, you know, cotton pickers.
You know, even if they want to stop this practice, can they really do it? So we will get into this topic in mechanics and challenges that might involve a little bit later. Again, coming back to you, Alison, I just saw your recommendations to Uzbek authorities based on your trip. Looking into this, one point kind of attracted me in which you say end mobilization of education and healthcare workers to harvest cotton and end the practice of forcing those who refuse to pay for replacement workers. So why not to just call instead, stop forcing people? It's not acceptable, just simple and straight.
Yes, the state should stop forcing people, but we wanted to be quite specific about the dynamic that's occurring in mobilization. You asked a question a moment ago, can the government really stop forcing people? And I would say yes. One benefit of having a centrally controlled, top-down system is that the government has tremendous control over what happens. As several of the colleagues on the call have already said, one of the root causes of forced labor is the quota system.
Alison, we will... Alison, we will get to this, but my point was in terms of your statements that I have seen released yesterday. In one point, you name education and healthcare workers, like, stop forcing those who refuse to pay for replacement workers. I was saying, like, instead of that, why just you straight and simply call, just don't force people to pick cotton. It's not acceptable.
It's not acceptable. One of the practices that the government has used to make it appear as though they're not forcing people is by requiring public sector workers to pay for others to pick in their name. So, for instance, last year in 2017, after the partial recall of health and education workers from the fields, instead of completely freeing them from obligations to the harvest, local authorities instead just forced them to pay for other people to pick cotton in their names.
Okay, I think...
If I could add to that.
Sure.
Our delegation did meet with the ILO monitoring project in Tashkent, and we've met with them on numerous occasions by phone and here in Washington as well. They've made it clear that the practice of telling public employees that either you must go pick cotton or you must pay for someone else to go pick cotton, when that option is added, that they consider that clearly forced labor. So the requirement to pay for someone else to go is forced labor just as much as making the person go into the field.
Okay, thank you, Rudy. So the question that I was referring to a little bit earlier, can they really abandon this forced labor in cotton fields? What has to happen so that it is abandoned? So we will continue Majlis talking about these and many other questions shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Ready for Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. In the light of a recent visit by cotton campaigners to Uzbekistan, we are discussing forced labor in the cotton fields of the country. Joining me in the discussion are Alison Gill, an associate with the Uzbek German Forum for Human Rights, Rudy Porter, head of the Europe and Central Asia programs at the Solidarity Center, Steve Sivertlu, Central Asia researcher with the Human Rights Watch, Bruce Panier, editor of Ready for Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlak Awazi. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, colleagues. So before I get into the second part of the discussion, just let me give some credit to the Uzbek authorities here. The fact that they are acknowledging the existence of this practice is a good news. And the fact that they want to abandon the practice is a great step. And the fact that they are engaging with NGOs to discuss ways to abandon it seems extraordinary. Now the question is, are they serious about it? In your recommendation list that I seen yesterday, you also say that to end this practice, the government of Uzbekistan need a comprehensive strategy, including time-bound, credible, measurable, and accountable steps to implement sustainable and irreversible operational changes in 2018, and further structural reforms to eliminate the systematic forced labor. And we are in 2018 already. So tell me, Alison, this during your conversation, and did you feel that they have any concrete roadmap to achieve these tasks?
Well, I think the government's main strategy right now is the privatization of the cotton sector. The government has made a commitment to move away from exports, and they're going to do more value-added processing, turning raw cotton into textiles and garments to create more jobs. So they have advanced a program they call the cluster system, by which the government is no longer part of the cotton production system. It will be a three-party agreement between a cotton producer, a farmer, a gin, and a textile company, like an integrated supply chain. So currently, 15% of cotton-producing agricultural land in Uzbekistan has now been turned over to this cluster system, so private production of cotton, private procurement of cotton. But the remaining 85% of cotton-producing land in 2018 is still being produced under the old system. The government established quotas where the government sets the procurement price and all of the rest, supply chain, controls all of the rest of the chain. So in our conversations, it was very clear the government was promoting the cluster system as its main plan, but we're really concerned because 85% of cotton is still going to be produced according to the quota system. And we view the quota system as one of the root causes of forced labor.
Rudy, having met with many officials face-to-face, are you clear at this stage where are they headed going forward? What kind of benchmarks they have in mind?
I think that they do not have a final plan yet at this stage. In fact, they were very open with us that they wanted further discussions as they develop a plan. I agree with Allison totally that clearly one part of their approach is going to be this cluster system, which allows farmers to choose what crops they'll raise. But as Allison said, that will be a very small part of the production this year, and 85% of the cotton will still be harvested in the same fashion that it was last year. So I would say, as far as the details, there's a number of aspects that we're looking for. One is to stop using government-controlled agencies, government-controlled or semi-government-controlled, like the Employers Association and the Trade Union Federation, both of which are clearly controlled by the government. And they're using them in the past, using them to recruit the people that are forced to work or to threaten punishment to people if they don't go out in the fields. Part of the plan has to be making sure that that stops. And unfortunately, we're receiving reports, even recent reports, that that has continued. So, when we say they need a plan, they need to look at all these aspects in order to get rid of the forced labor.
Steve, the way it sounds like it, what we are getting from Uzbekistan is just really a mixed signal of what they want to do. Question that we earlier raised, let's believe for a minute that they want to achieve this goal. They want to stop the forced labor in the cotton fields. So even if they want that, can they achieve it?
Well, I think there's definitely, we've been talking on the podcast a lot about the high-level commitment from the government, and I think at least from parts of it, and certainly, we think including from the president, which is extremely important for doing what your question asks. But I think the other part of this is that there is a momentum that one feels inside Uzbekistan, that the public, I think, has come awake in some ways, or, you know, it's hard to generalize about it. 30 million people, but again, I think there's something has definitely changed in the last 20 months, where I think citizens have higher expectations about many aspects of Uzbek society, and I think one of those central expectations is that this sort of barbaric practice goes by the wayside, and I think you meet journalists, young journalists, and the activists that we've worked with for years, but also people that are just coming into this sector, people that are getting trained and coming to some of these events that are being put on about cotton, there seems to be a hope and a higher set of expectations that this practice changed. So I think hopefully we see the government being held accountable. I think beyond all the measures that we're asking for, this won't really be possible unless you have a public and a civil society and a media that are able to watch what happens, participate in what happens, and you know, support that effort. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to handle in a completely top-down way.
Hmm. Bruce, earlier you had a question on how can the authorities stop it, even if they want to stop it. And Alison kind of had an answer to that question. So please your comment, and I will let Alison to answer that.
You know, Steve kind of just hit that nail right on the head there with that. If you have greater checks on the field, if you're willing to allow the media to go out there and report, you know, it, more or less freely on what's going on, you can kind of keep some checks on this. It's going to be tough. Like I said, every October they hold a cotton fair in Uzbekistan, and they sell their cotton off to everyone. Last year they said they sold $1 billion worth of cotton, and I personally don't believe that they really did. But anyway, this is the kind of money that we're talking about here. You know, so they can't give it up. I mean, at the moment, they really can't. I don't see how they can do that. They said they would invest in cotton gins and, you know, and get everything so that less and less people had to do that. Again, I didn't see the money going that way, but if it's not coming anytime soon, I suppose one option they could consider would be to pay better wages to people. They might actually look at all the people that go to work as migrant laborers in Russia and Turkey and stuff. Like I said, picking cotton is no fun. You know, I've spent days out there, and it's not something you look forward to. Yeah. But on the other hand, there is a lot of unemployment in Uzbekistan. If you could pay a fair wage of some kind to people, then, you know, maybe you could get some people to go out there voluntarily, more or less, you know, as a regular job, not have a bag thrown at them and say, for every 50 kilos that you have to pick, we will give you, you know, 50 cents or something like that. But you know, like something, some real money behind it. And that's why privatization, of course, would be a much better solution down the line.
So, Alison, and let's take your point on that. If they want to end this practice, like as Bruce was saying, that they were making millions out of this, are you really optimistic that they will just give it up, give it away?
It's true the government was making a lot of hard currency on cotton production, but that was before currency convertibility. Now that currency has been converted and there is less of a difference between the official exchange rate and the black market exchange rate, that big gap in currency is much, much less. And the government is really, I think, truly pushing privatization and trying to get out of cotton production. It's a very inefficient system with a lot of abuses up and down the chain. I just want to respond to something that Bruce has said a couple times about mechanization. Mechanization is not a kind of golden arrow that's going to immediately solve the problem. It's one possible solution, but ultimately, it should be up to the farmer to decide what's for his or her land. Some land is suitable for mechanized cotton harvesting, some land is not. And in fact, a significant number of cotton pickers are voluntary and do pick cotton to earn money. So then this we actually saw as a key change in 2017. Prices paid to pickers were raised significantly for the first time. There have been small increments year to year, but last year was the first sort of significant increment. And I think it really did have an effect on voluntariness, because for rural people, in particular, people who are living in the areas where the farms are, this is a really important form of seasonal employment. The difficulty comes later in the season. So if you know, cotton blooms in several, ripens in several passes. And so early in the season, mid-September, late September, they're not available, easy to pick because it's so abundant and people can earn a lot of money. Later in the season, the amount of cotton that's available to pick drops off significantly. The conditions get worse. It's colder, and it becomes much harder to earn a decent wage. And we see voluntariness drop off significantly. So that's something that the government really has to grapple with is, and again, this goes back to the quota system. The local officials really push people to go into the fields and force people to go into the fields because they're so anxious about meeting their government quotas or they face quotas. And the quota system and wages are going to be crucial reforms for the government to tackle in combating forced labor.
So we kind of, over time, unfortunately, we should end the discussion very soon. But let's take a final notes here. Rudy, so what is on your checklist? What will you be following going forward?
What's on the top of the checklist of my organization follows to what Bruce talked about on, in addition to raising wages and paying people a living wage to pick cotton, we think it's critically important that they have the freedom of association to form unions or other worker organizations that are completely independent of the government that represent the members, so that the people that the farm workers that go out and pick cotton actually can join an organization and bargain collectively and raise their wages, monitor their health conditions, monitor the safety in the fields, monitor the conditions in the dormitories where they're housed. They need independent organizations that they do not have now. The government should stop appointing the people that run trade unions and allow the workers to have independent organizations.
Okay. Alison, your checklist. So what are the benchmarks that you are looking at going forward?
We're really looking to see independent civil society flourish and be allowed to operate, including monitoring the fields, reporting on what they find, and helping to hold the government accountable.
Okay. Steve, so what would what are the indications that would reflect that they are really on the roadmap or they are delivering the promise?
I echo the checklists just stated by Allison and Rudy, independent civil society, independent emergence of truly independent unions. Those things are absolutely key. I think, you know, another sort of story that illustrates the tensions here and the expectations we have. When I had a meeting with the Federation of Trade Unions, they had set up what they believe is a mechanism to gather complaints, what they call a feedback mechanism, from people that are forced to pick cotton and that are, you know, that are trying to report it to the authority. And, you know, that system is really just in its beginning stages. It remains pretty weak and ineffective, but it's a start. And I remember one conversation we had a few months ago with the monitors working there. And I said to them, do you read what Radio Free Europe publishes almost every day about instances of forced labor? And do you incorporate those critical reports into what you look at? And interestingly, they said, you know, we try to, but the internet is still blocked. Mm-hmm. And we have to use proxy servers just to get onto that website. And of course, we want to take that information to account, but it's difficult. And it was a really frank and honest answer, which to me illustrated the tensions that I think the government has to commit to really, as we've been talking about, opening up the curtains, allowing there to be really critical discussion on all levels and all aspects, being upfront. And that is going to be painful for the government to allow journalists and lawyers and everyone that needs to be involved in this to really peer into the corruption that exists in a lot of the corridors and corners of Uzbekistan. So that's going to be key. And I think we have to mention at the end here that without continued pressure from the World Bank, which I think has a responsibility to take a really hard look at its financing of the agricultural sector and making sure they have independent third-party monitors going into their areas and making sure that forced labor is stopped. Without that and without the European Union and the U.S. government continuing to push the Uzbek government, make sure they understand there's going to be in June, very soon, a ranking of Uzbekistan in the State Department Trafficking in Persons report. And we're going to see whether or not Uzbekistan gets a higher grade or it stays where it is. Right now, it's in Tier 3, which means that you still have state-sponsored forced labor on a massive scale. And we'll see what happens. But I think without that increased, that continued pressure, it's going to be difficult. So we need all of those things to happen, and we're all going to be working to hold the government accountable, but also to to work with them and be open about our roadmap and what we think are essential ingredients for change.
So Bruce, a final point from you. What are the steps and points in your point of view which would indicate that they are on the right path going forward?
As we've heard, you know, Allison and Rudy and Steve, I mean, they pretty much covered all that territory. For me, in the short term, this year, what I would like to see is instead of an occasional mention from President Mirziyoyev or some other government official that you shouldn't be forced into the fields, they could run a very effective campaign for at a very low cost, street signs, you know, posters and stuff that say you can't be forced into the fields. If I could go to Uzbekistan, which of course I can't, but if I go to Uzbekistan and see those same hillsides that say cotton is our white gold and then have a little note on the side saying, but you shouldn't be forced to go out and pick it, you know, it's a reminder to officials in the region and everywhere around the country and the people that they shouldn't be forced to go out to. It changed the mentality a little bit, you know, make it visual reinforcement that this is wrong and you shouldn't be forced out and people shouldn't force you out into the fields.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlog Owozi, for your insightful comments. And also big thanks goes to our guests, Alice Engel, associate with the Uzbek German Forum for Human Rights, Rudy Porter, head of the Europe and Central Asia programs at the All Solidarity Center, and Steve Sewerloo, Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thanks, Mohammed.
Thank you. It was very nice to have
you.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week. Bye-bye.